Around 5 a.m. on the morning of January 4th, 2019, a man in the small County Donegal village of Killigordon is woken by the noise of shouting and screaming outside. He looks out and sees Gardaí at the home of one of his neighbours. He's unsure what to make of the scene. He thinks it must be a late party that's attracted Garda attention. He returns to bed. About 2 hours later, shortly after 7 a.m, he wakes again and looks out. There are more Gardaí now, some wearing helmets and holding shields. There are Gardaí with guns. They are watching the neighbour's house. He then sees them rush to the front door of the house, bursting through it with guns drawn. 17 days later, on January 21st, I receive a piece of evidence from a Garda member in Donegal. It's a handwritten letter from the pen of Jasmine McMonagall, a young mother of two small girls. It covers 4 pages with her neat handwriting. Her words could fill in an unknown chapter in a harrowing story. A story that brought those armed Gardaí to that quiet estate in Donegal on that cold January morning. Across those pages, I read Jasmine's words. I'm sick of you thinking you can do whatever you want and get away with it. You held me hostage in my own garden for hours after breaking in. For weeks, I was too scared to go back into my garden in case you were waiting there. You threatened to kill me and my daughter. She wrote, I'm not living in fear anymore. She ended her letter with, never again. When someone is murdered in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a team of forensic scenes of crime examiners from the Technical Bureau. And for 25 years, I was a part of that team. My name is John Sweetman. I was there to help read the silent and often hidden clues at a crime scene. I saw what killers tried to hide. Fingerprints unknowingly left behind. Murder weapons hidden in plain sight. Handwriting that betrayed a lie. Every detail told the real story. And now, I'll tell you those stories. In this new podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting crimes. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that looks beyond the headlines, following the evidence step by step and uncovering the stories behind the investigations. In this episode, the brutal killing of 28-year-old Jasmine McMonagall, a tragic story of rage, loss and bravery, and a chilling example of when someone who should be a person's partner and protector becomes their greatest threat. The River Finn meanders through the north of Ireland for almost 40 miles. Rising from long, narrow Loch Finn in Donegal, it flows through numerous small towns and villages before joining the River Mourne and flowing into the Northern Channel via Loch Foyle. Steely blue Atlantic salmon can be seen swimming upstream, battling the force of the river, leaping out of the water over sharp rocks and waterfalls to reach the spawning grounds. It is one of the best rivers in the country for salmon fishing, and throughout the year, patient fishermen don waders to stand in the rushing water, hoping for a bite. The area that the river flows through is called the Finn Valley, and from the sea, the river is navigable all the way to the village of Castle Finn. On the 20th of February 1990, along the banks of the River Finn in County Donegal, Jasmine McMonagall was born. She was her mother Jacqueline's middle child. Jasmine lived with her mother, older sister Jenna, and younger brother Christopher on the outskirts of Castle Finn village. Growing up, she had always been creative, and writing was a passion of hers. She often wrote poems and stories, and her dream was to one day become an author of children's books. In 2007, 17-year-old Jasmine wrote a poem for her grandmother, who had passed away, and she went on to get a tattoo in her honour that read, Gran Rose. She had a great respect for the elderly, and had been very close to her grandmother, as well as all her family. When she first moved out of home, she only went as far as moving into Castlefin village, still staying close to where she had grown up, only a stone's throw from her family. There was always laughter when she was around. Her family thought she was hilarious and loved her cheeky smile that would stretch for miles. Those who knew her well thought Jasmine was kind and caring. She had worked briefly as a youth worker. She was interested in people, liked to study them. One day, she thought, she might actually become a private investigator. She used to play a game with her grandmother and mother when they were in a crowd. They'd silently make their observations of the scene around them and then compare notes, laughing as they did so. Small, blonde and petite, Jasmine took great pride in her appearance and good looks, and even had done a bit of modelling. She loved to follow fashion, even creating her own trends. In 2015, she moved into number 49 in the estate of Forest Park in the tiny village of Killigordon, 5 kilometres away from Castlefin, with her little girl from a prior relationship that had since run its course. Jasmine and the little girl's father had split, but remained on good terms. It was around this time that Jasmine first encountered a man called Richard Burke on an internet chat room. They exchanged messages for a while before losing contact, but around a year later, they began speaking again, this time through Facebook, and the two arranged to meet. Things progressed quickly, with Burke calling to see Jasmine at her house. He would later say that he fell in love as soon as she opened the door. At the time, Burke was homeless and out of work, and he had had a checkered past, characterized by struggles and mistakes. Richard Burke had been born in North London in 1991, and had moved to Ireland to live with his grandparents when he was 8. His father, who was a truck driver, and his mother, a nurse, soon moved back to Ireland also, along with Richard's younger brother. Burke began smoking cannabis in his teens, and it was this burgeoning drug habit which led to him dropping out of college at Letterkenny IT shortly after beginning his studies. He began to frequent a local head shop. Head shops existed within a loophole in Irish law at the time, which allowed them to legally sell potent drugs, such as methadone and synthetic cannabinoids. In later years, after the drugs had been outlawed, studies done at Cambridge University and elsewhere found that there was a link between these drugs and psychosis, with them being particularly dangerous for people with a history of mental illness. Burke had been experimenting with anything he could get his hands on, calling the various concoctions on sale at the head shop pretend ecstasy and pretend cocaine. He soon found himself expelled from his parents' house, and he was homeless for some time. Burke could never hold onto a job for long. At various times he had part-time employment as a chimney sweep, a cobbler, a waiter in a hotel, but none of these positions lasted very long. Soon, he began to come to the attention of the Gardaí, and he quickly racked up 23 various convictions, appearing on multiple occasions at the district court for possession of drugs, criminal damage, assault, possession of knives, and various other public order offences. Burke had even robbed the local head shop that he was so fond of visiting. Jasmine's sister, Jenna, who had been living away, had heard about some of his issues, but not the full extent of his behaviour. She had only met him once or twice and thought he was nothing special, but didn't see any warning signs in what little she did see. Richard moved in with Jasmine and her daughter at the house in Killigordon, and the couple began trying for a baby. By December 2016, Jasmine was pregnant. But even at this early stage in their relationship, problems were emerging. Jasmine never hinted to her sister that there was anything going on, but privately she wrote a letter to Burke, detailing the torment he was putting her through. It made for harrowing reading. Jasmine didn't want him living in the home. She had reached her limit. His behaviour was, as she wrote it, disrupting the household. Jasmine wrote a letter at the time, describing how, when she had been sick in hospital, he had stolen money from her coat and had threatened that she wouldn't have a home to come back to. He had brought drugs into the house, and she had heard him on the phone making plans to sell pills with his friends. He was often drunk and threatening, trying to smash the house up and telling Jasmine that she was lucky to be breathing. And any other girl would have got punched. She wrote of how he threatened to kill her and her young daughter, and how he had even beaten the puppy, dragging it in from the garden. She wrote that he was beating the puppy so hard, I could hear it upstairs. In the letter, she described how Richard completely ruined Christmas for us, lying in a heap on drugs and refusing to leave, making me move all my Santa stuff to my mom's house to do it there. So Burke moved out, but he continued to try to patch things up. Jasmine recalled an incident in which he had held her hostage in her own garden for hours after breaking in. Even though she was visibly throwing up, he had made her sit there for hours until he decided to leave. She lived in a state of fear. For weeks, she was too scared to go into her own back garden in case Burke was sitting there waiting. He called to the house every day, trying to convince her to take him back, but she wasn't interested. In an attempt to win her back, Burke managed to scrape together enough money to buy a second-hand Nissan Micra, intending it to be a gift for Jasmine, with a notion that he could teach her how to drive. By now, Richard Burke was 25 years old, and he already had a serious drugs and alcohol addiction. One morning, after Jasmine McMonagall continued to spurn his attempts at a reconciliation, Burke woke up absolutely fuming, as he put it. He purchased and consumed a large amount of cannabis and alcohol before getting behind the wheel of the Nissan Micra. This was the car that he had purportedly bought for Jasmine. He crashed it and set it on fire. He had been due to appear in court that day for another matter, but with his brain clouded by alcohol and drugs, he never turned up. It appears his addictions were growing more severe, and the problems they were sparking were growing more serious. His behavior was becoming increasingly destructive and volatile. Jasmine and Richard remained apart, even after Jasmine gave birth to a baby girl. When she gave birth, Richard wasn't at the hospital, and he would later say Jasmine hadn't told him about the birth. Instead, Jasmine's sister, Jenna, was by her side. Richard sunk further into his addictions. However, at the end of September 2017, the pair reconnected. Burke had begun to call around to the house in Killigordon, gradually worming his way back in the relationship. What convinced her isn't clear, although we do know Jasmine had been weighing it up and would tell her sister she was unsure what to do. For a short while, things seemed to be going well, but whatever passed for normalcy when sharing a home with Richard Burke wasn't to last. He started having delusions that Jasmine was being unfaithful, that she was even giving drugs to the kids. His behavior was becoming so erratic that in January 2018, Jasmine had to resort to calling the Gardaí. After speaking with them, Burke agreed to voluntarily admit himself to a psychiatric unit for a period. He said he only wanted to go to ensure that he was not going mad. Under the care of the psychiatric unit, Burke admitted to having auditory hallucinations and paranoid delusions. He was suffering from a mental illness and symptoms of psychosis. It wasn't the first time that he'd been assessed. In 2011, almost 8 years earlier, when he was 19 years old, he had tried to take his own life. He also had a history of self-harm, and when he was assessed following his failed suicide attempt, he was judged to have some of the symptoms of an avoidant personality disorder. He was also, in the psychiatrist's opinion, someone who could benefit from anger management treatment. Burke's admission to psychiatric care wasn't a turning point that Jasmine might have hoped for. In hindsight, it seemed to change little, and the course he had been on remained unaltered. After his stint in psychiatric care, Richard Burke was soon back living in Jasmine's house in Killigordon. As Christmas of 2018 neared, there were few outward signs of hope. When Jasmine's sister Jenna visited the house in the days before Christmas to exchange presents with Jasmine and the two girls, Richard remained in bed. Jenna should have seen Jasmine again on Christmas Day at the family home, but Jasmine didn't make it. She told her family she was unwell with the flu. Her absence was felt deeply. Jasmine had always made a big fuss, bigger than most people, for Christmas and birthdays. It was one of those things that made Jasmine so special to her family. It would be 10 days later, on January 4th, that Richard Burke's threats and volatile behaviour would reach its deadly peak. And see Gardaí rushing to the home in the quiet estate outside the small town of Killygordon in the middle of the night as they responded to Jasmine's desperate call for help. It was in the very early hours of the morning of the 4th of January 2019 when Richard Burke's menacing threats and volatile behaviour would spiral beyond a point of no return. In those dark hours, the small, tidy Forest Park estate in Killygordon was quiet. The neat rows of detached and semi-detached houses and the wooded area behind them were in darkness. But, in number 49 Forest Park, Jasmine McMonagall and Richard Burke had not yet gone to bed. They were in the kitchen, listening to music. The two small children were upstairs asleep. As usual, Burke had been drinking heavily. Also, for the last few days he had been taking Lyrica, a medication commonly prescribed for anxiety and mood problems. Drinking alcohol while on any medication never has a good outcome, and mixing Lyrica with the amount of vodka that Burke had consumed that night could easily have affected his judgment and behaviour. For reasons known only to himself, Richard Burke began to get angry and threatened Jasmine, who he wouldn't let out of his sight. He warned her, "You'll see a different side of me if you don't cop on." We don't know exactly what unfolded in those hours, but we do know his mood continued to worsen, as did the severity of his threats. It was after 4 a.m. when Jasmine finally managed to steal a few minutes away from his company. When she did, she made a 999 call to Gardaí, telling them that she was in fear for her life. At 4:21 a.m, a patrol car was immediately dispatched from Lifford, making the 16-kilometre journey to Killygordon along dark country roads. They sped through the cold darkness, along roads cloaked in the pitch black of the Donegal winter night, a darkness maybe only broken by the occasional Christmas tree lights, still up and sparkling in the windows of homes along the road. In that part of the country, Gardaí often have to cover wide distances to reach the scene of emergency calls. 20 minutes after Jasmine's call, the squad car turned off the main road and ascended the gentle hill that led into the estate. As the two Gardaí in the patrol car pulled up to number 49, they found a home with no outward signs of disturbance and saw that the curtains were all drawn. A brown front door to the left-hand side of the house was framed by panes of frosted glass. Two rows of grey stone ran the length of the house, standing either side of the sitting room window and a large bedroom window upstairs. The guards knocked sharply on the front door, but there was no answer. They went to the rear of the house and found the curtains pulled over the kitchen window. They also saw what appeared to be a towel covering another window. They knocked on the glass of the kitchen window. Inside, Burke looked down at Jasmine and called her name before checking her pulse. In his hand was a length of blue rope. Concerned for Jasmine's well-being, the Gardaí radioed for advice on if they should force an entry. When given the go-ahead, they retrieved the glass breaker from the patrol car and used it to smash a window at the rear of the house. As they did, a crazed-looking Burke appeared before them in blood-stained clothes. He was holding a meat cleaver. He identified himself as Charlie Thatcher and told the Gardaí members they had no business being there. Attempts to subdue Burke proved futile. The Gardaí pepper-sprayed him, but he was wearing glasses and it seemed the spray had no effect. Burke moved away from the Gardaí into the utility room. And when they tried to follow, he emerged swinging at them with the large knife. he slashed the sleeve of one of them, narrowly missing his arm. The Gardaí had to pull back, and the call went out for assistance. Soon, other patrol cars from the surrounding sub-districts arrived at the scene. Once again, one of the guards made his way to the rear of the house. He managed to peer into the kitchen through a small gap in the curtains. He saw a discarded slipper and part of someone's leg on the floor, surrounded by a large pool of blood. The rest of the body was obscured from view. Nearby, a little dog lay curled up and shaking. The situation had escalated to a standoff, and the services of a trained guard and negotiator were requested. At 6:15 a.m., still in the full dark of the early January morning, the specially trained negotiator arrived on the scene. He was equipped with the skills required to handle high-stakes situations, including hostage situations where individuals or others in their company were at risk of harm or violence. The negotiator would be the sole person to engage in verbal contact with Richard Bourke and would try to de-escalate the crisis and find out the condition of those inside the house, whilst also coordinating with the other Garda members at the scene. Bourke informed the negotiator that there were two young children upstairs in bed. When he was asked about Jasmine, Bourke said that she was sleeping. Again and again, requests were made to let the Gardaí inside, but Bourke continued to deny anyone access. Meanwhile, as the negotiator continued to try and reason with Bourke, the Garda Armed Response Unit was being mobilised. The Armed Response Unit, or ARU, comes under the remit of the Special Tactics Operational Command, with a dedicated unit in each of the four Garda regions in Ireland: the Dublin Metropolitan Region, or the DMR, the Southern Region, the Eastern Region, and the Northwestern Region, in which Donegal is located. The ASU is a specialist unit whose members are trained in handling high-risk situations, such as armed confrontations and hostage situations, and are experts in tactical operations and crisis management. They carry a combination of lethal firearms, including semi-automatic pistols, shotguns and submachine guns, as well as non-lethal weapons such as tasers, pepper spray and beanbag shotguns. When the members of the Armed Response Unit arrived at the home, Richard Bourke had not made any concessions to the negotiator. With the curtains on all the windows drawn, the view inside the home was limited. The frosted glass of the front door was their only option to track his movements. Peering through the scopes of their guns, they could make out the blurred shape of Bourke as he moved about the house. Through that magnified view, they could pick up some signs of movement, intermittent shapes or silhouettes shifting around inside that might betray a clue of what was unfolding inside the locked home. At 7:29 a.m, Gardaí watching the home looked through their scopes and saw Bourke moving behind the frosted glass. They followed him from the kitchen at the rear of the house into the hallway. There, he appeared to bend down into the storage area under the stairs. What the watching Gardaí could not see was that in that storage area lay a bag containing knives, hammers, and a balaclava. At the same time, a paramedic outside was observing the house, and looking at the upstairs window, spotted a young girl. It was Jasmine's 8-year-old daughter. There could be no more waiting. Gardaí decided that they had to make an immediate and forced entry into the house. The ASU burst open the front door. Bourke had barricaded himself at the rear of the house, in the kitchen area. He had jammed a high chair against the door. The armed Gardaí quickly cleared the obstruction, only to be confronted by Bourke, who was wielding a glass-breaking hammer. Gardaí immediately tasered and handcuffed him, and frisked him for any other weapons. In his jacket, Gardaí found a large knife in a scabbard. He also had two mobile phones on him, his own and Jasmine's, the one she had made the earlier 999 call on. Across the road, a neighbour watched as Gardaí brought Bourke out, shouting at him to get on the grass, get on the grass. Later, they watched as a guard carried one of the girls out in his arms, while Jasmine's other daughter was with another guard at the front door. Both of the children had been upstairs all night, but when the guards had first arrived, the older girl had come down calling for her mammy. Gardaí entered the home and found 28-year-old Jasmine McMonagall in a pool of her own blood on the kitchen floor. When they found Jasmine, her little dog was still curled up beside her. It was clear to everyone in the room that she was already dead. At Burke's hands, she had suffered a ferocious and sustained beating. The attack that she had sustained had been so vicious that one of her blonde hair extensions was found on the draining board. Another lay on the floor near the doorway into the hall. The meat cleaver, which Burke had used to threaten the guards and called his special knife, was recovered in the kitchen. Also found were a length of blue rope and a dressing gown belt, which appeared to have some of Jasmine's hair on it. The services of the Technical Bureau were requested. Meanwhile, Dr. Martin Coyne, who had a medical practice in nearby Lifford and had known Jasmine for years, attended at the scene and pronounced her dead. Once the Bureau arrived, they completed a preliminary examination of the scene with Jasmine's body still in situ. As part of this examination, experts took note of the blood spatter in the kitchen. The pattern showed them that Jasmine had been crouched or laying in the corner of the room while the vicious attack took place. Burke had attempted to wipe some of the blood off the walls and cupboards. State pathologist Dr. Linda Mulligan carried out a post-mortem and found that Jasmine's death was as a result of cerebral anoxia, a lack of oxygen to the brain. She had been strangled. Dr. Mulligan noted that a 1 centimetre diameter mark on her neck had likely been made with the piece of blue rope or the dressing gown belt that were found near the body. Officially, the cause of death was ligature strangulation, with multiple traumatic injuries to the head and trunk as contributing factors. The blunt force trauma injuries, in her opinion, could have been caused by fists, feet, or perhaps even the glass-breaking hammer. It was also Dr. Mulligan's opinion that Jasmine McMonagall had already been unconscious when she was strangled. After his arrest at the scene in Forest Park, Richard Burke was taken to Letterkenny Garda Station. A psychiatrist was called to assess him, and he was deemed fit to be interviewed. Over the course of the next few hours, Gardaí grilled him, and Burke made a full admission that he had indeed killed Jasmine. He told Gardaí how things had started in the kitchen whilst the two of them had been listening to music. But the situation really got out of control when he realised Jasmine had phoned the guards. He said he was shouting and screaming. "Once I heard guards, that was the end of it." He said that he went ballistic. Absolutely fucking ballistic. "I have a real bad temper. I just blanked. Because I hate guards, I started punching the fuck out of her, then strangling her with a rope." He then said that he was only trying to make her see sense. He even acted out how he had strangled Jasmine, telling Gardaí he was still holding the rope when the first two Gardaí knocked at the kitchen window. He told them that this was the moment that Jasmine's 8-year-old daughter had come downstairs looking for her mammy. Burke told Gardaí this was when he came round, as he put it, and used the high chair to block the door. He denied having used his special knife or any other weapons on Jasmine, stating that he hated violence towards women. In the same breath, he said, "I didn't use weapons, just fists. There was blood everywhere." When Gardaí asked him how long the beating had lasted and how many times he had struck Jasmine, Burke replied, "How long is a piece of string?" He told them, "I was like a bull. There was no one to stop me. I killed her. I didn't want to, man. I loved her so much." The investigating Gardaí had their admission. Richard Burke had confessed to killing Jasmine McMonagall. Sergeant Michael Galvin charged Burke with her murder. In reply to the charge, Burke said, "I understand everything." He was remanded in custody, and over the coming months, a plethora of material was compiled for the book of evidence pending his trial, including one particular exhibit, the letter that Jasmine had written to Burke some time before the birth of her second child, which would find its way to my desk in the Garda handwriting examination section. It seemed like an open and shut case of murder, but, as so often happens in seemingly unambiguous prosecutions, things turned out not to be quite so straightforward. Jasmine's sister Jenna was staying in their mother's home on January 4th. She was 8 months pregnant. That morning, Gardaí called to the house to deliver the tragic, terrifying, and earth-shattering news. Richard Burke had killed Jasmine. The first thing Jenna could ask was if Jasmine's daughters were okay. Jasmine McMonagall's funeral took place on Monday the 7th of January 2019 at St. Mary's Church in Castlefin. Hundreds of people turned out to pay their respects and to offer their support to her heartbroken family, her mother Jacqueline, her sister Jenna, her brother Christopher, and her two little girls. Father Oliver Crilly spoke of Jasmine, saying, "She loved to give. She spoiled her wee brother Christopher when he was young, and even now when he was 22 years old." He continued, saying, "Bereavement around Christmas time is harder, but bereavement associated with cruel trauma is the hardest of all." He added that Jasmine had always presented herself well. "She didn't just follow fashions," he added. "She loved to be different, to be herself." They brought offertory gifts to the altar, including a printed copy of the poem Jasmine had written for her grandmother Rose, as well as a photograph of her two daughters. Her brother Christopher called his sister a flower and wrote a poem about her, which was read out by a friend. At the end of the funeral, Jasmine's coffin was led from the church as one of her favourite songs was played, "Ain't No Mountain High Enough" by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Tyrrell. Jasmine McMonagall was then laid to rest beside her beloved gran, Rose, in the nearby Castlefin Cemetery. In the months following Jasmine McMonagall's death at the hands of Richard Burke, Gardaí had to collect and compile all of the evidence needed for his trial for murder. One small but not unimportant piece of this evidence found its way to my desk in the document and handwriting examination section in Garda headquarters. On the 21st of January 2019, a little over 2 weeks after Jasmine had been killed, I received an exhibit from a Garda member in Letterkenny. It was the handwritten letter that Jasmine had written to Richard Burke sometime prior to the birth of her second child. The investigation team needed to prove its authorship, as it contained details of Burke's abusive behaviour, which would be important in painting a picture of Jasmine's life with him leading up to her death. The letter was undated and spread over 4 pages in Jasmine's neat and fluent handwriting. It began, "Richard, I'm sick of you thinking you can do whatever you want and get away with it." Jasmine was strong and defiant. "I'm not living in fear anymore. You are a thief and an abusive woman beater with some serious mental problems. You can find someone else to threaten to kill." Jasmine's bravery struck home for me. I couldn't imagine how difficult it must have been for her, living in the dark shadow cast by Richard Burke. Jasmine ended the letter with 2 words, "Never again." But Burke would continue to make her life hell for at least another 18 months after she had written that letter. In order to prove the authorship of the letter, I also had been given a known sample of Jasmine McMonagall's handwriting. It was from an application form for social housing support. She had filled it in her neat handwriting and dated it 4th of January 2017. exactly 2 years to the day before Richard Bourke had killed her. She had been hoping to find a bigger house, as the one in Forest Park was small and she was expecting her second child. But the cramped house in Killygordon would, tragically, turn out to be her final address. There was sufficient handwriting for me to carry out a comparison with the letter that she had written, enabling me to give a strong opinion of common authorship. However, I would not get the chance to present my evidence in court. The formal inquest into Jasmine McMonagall's death was opened in October of 2019, but was adjourned as Richard Bourke's trial for her murder was due to begin on June 10th of 2020. The family prepared themselves to sit through the cold reality of a courtroom and the painful details of Jasmine's death, only for the COVID-19 pandemic and the ensuing lockdown to delay things even further. This left the family deflated as they waited for justice for Jasmine. It wouldn't be until March 2023, over 4 years after Jasmine's death, that Bourke stood to face a judge and jury in the Central Criminal Court sitting in Monaghan Town. Although Bourke had pleaded not guilty to murder, the court was told that there was no dispute between the prosecution and the defence regarding the details of the killing. The facts of Jasmine's killing were agreed upon by both the prosecution and the defence, so much of the evidence was accepted by both sides, meaning that certain witnesses were not called to testify, me included. It was the defence's case that Richard Bourke's actions should be attributed to diminished responsibility on the night in question. They argued that he was suffering from mental illness and not of his right mind when he attacked Jasmine. Forensic psychiatrist Dr. Anthony Kearns, who had treated Bourke when he had been voluntarily admitted to a psychiatric unit in 2018, spoke of his delusions about Jasmine being unfaithful and giving drugs to the children. A Garda member, who had interviewed Bourke following his arrest, gave evidence that he had asked him about his Charlie Thatcher alias, which Bourke had introduced himself as, to the two Gardaí who first gained entry through the house. Bourke said that he also went by this name and that he had held an important position, owning several banks. He also said he was a skilled martial artist and had fought UFC world champions. Another psychiatrist, Dr. Dervla Duffy of the Central Mental Hospital, said that the description of Richard Bourke when he was examined in 2018 echoed aspects of his presentation in January of 2019 following Jasmine's death. She also gave evidence of Bourke's history of self-harm and his failed suicide attempt when he was 19. She stated that Bourke had told her that in the weeks before he killed Jasmine, he was tired of the torment he was living. Dr. Anthony Kearns also said that Richard Bourke's fragile mental state was complicated by his abuse of drugs and alcohol over many years. Dr. Duffy added that it was her opinion that Bourke was acutely psychotic when he killed Jasmine, and for a short period afterwards. Both experts agreed that Richard Bourke had been suffering from this acute psychosis at the time, and that this substantially diminished his responsibility. The prosecution barrister, Anne-Marie Lawler, SC, and the defence counsel, Michael Bowman, SC, also agreed that there was no evidence to suggest that both psychiatrists were incorrect in their conclusions. Both the prosecution and the defence agreed that Bourke's mental state at the time meant he bore a diminished responsibility for his crime. Lawler, the prosecution barrister, in her final address to the jury, acknowledged that Jasmine's death was senseless and horrific, and that it would be impossible for the jury not to have enormous sympathy for her family. However, she reminded them that this sympathy must be put aside when making the decision on the verdict. She told the jury, "Putting sympathy aside will be difficult, but it is nevertheless required of you. In considering the evidence, you are called upon to apply the law in accordance with your oath." The defence barrister, Michael Bowman, SC, echoed that, telling the jury that the evidence of the psychiatrists about Bourke's mental state meant he should be found guilty of manslaughter, but not murder. Mr. Justice Paul Burns addressed the jury, telling them that all parties had agreed to the evidence. He also stated that all the evidence now pointed to manslaughter. The jury now had to arrive at one of three verdicts: guilty of murder, not guilty of murder, or not guilty of murder but guilty of manslaughter due to diminished responsibility. After a little over an hour of deliberation, the jury returned. Richard Bourke was found guilty of manslaughter due to diminished responsibility. In May of 2023, Bourke's sentence hearing took place. Justice Paul Burns noted that although the killing of Jasmine had been complicated by the use of drugs and alcohol, it was Bourke's delusion that had been the primary pathological factor. The judge mentioned Bourke's previous detention under the Mental Health Act and of how a friend of Jasmine's had expressed concern for her safety that same year. Richard Bourke had made previous threats and had been heard to say, "I'll bury her, I'll kill the bitch, I'll throw her under a bus." He had also told someone that he would like to strangle her. Justice Burns said that Bourke had continued to abuse drugs and alcohol, even though he had to have been aware of the potential side effects. The fact that Jasmine had been killed in her own home while her two children were present in the house, as well as the ferocity of the attack on her, were all mentioned as aggravating factors in the case. The judge imposed a sentence of 15 years, suspending the final year. It was backdated to when Bourke first went into custody in January of 2019. He was also ordered to undergo psychiatric assessment and remain under post-release supervision for 5 years. In her victim impact statement, Jasmine's mother, Jacqueline, said that on the 4th of January 2019, "my world fell apart." She said that the family had all been given a life sentence of suffering and pain and of missing someone so kind and generous who they were never going to see again. Her mother told the court how Christmas means nothing to me anymore and how she still has difficulty believing she will never see her daughter again. "The pain I feel is indescribable," she said. "I do not feel like the person I once was. I had my daughter taken from me in the most horrific way." The manner in which her daughter died left Jacqueline feeling traumatized. She said she repeatedly goes over the events of that night, wondering if Jasmine called out her name and how long she suffered before she died. She told the court she was haunted by how powerless her daughter must have felt and that she wasn't there to protect her. About Richard Bourke, she added, "The only word that comes to mind is evil." Jasmine's eldest daughter, who was now 12 years old, also had a chance to speak. She said that Richard Bourke had ruined our lives, and both she and her little sister would never get Mammy back. "I wish Mammy had never met him." She had always thought that Richard Bourke was a bad person. She said that he had tried to teach Jasmine martial arts, but what she really needed protection from was him. Jasmine's previous partner, the father of her eldest daughter, stated that the girl lived in constant fear that Bourke might escape justice and kill her, or her little sister. "This animal has ruined my child's life." He told the court that the family had decided to move away from the village where the brutal death had occurred, and how, since moving schools, his daughter had lost touch with all her old friends and had become withdrawn. She was also separated from her younger sister, who now lives with her Aunt Jenna, Jasmine's sister. Jenna calls the girl her daughter and says she has two mummies now. Jenna would later say one of the greatest pains of it all was that the two young sisters were separated, and although they remain close and see each other frequently, they are heartbroken each time they have to part. Jenna would speak of Bourke saying, "I could call him a monster or an animal, but quite frankly, that would be disrespectful to monsters and animals. Richard Bourke is something else." Following Richard Bourke's trial, the coroner's inquest into Jasmine McMonagall's death was briefly reopened, but her family decided not to proceed with a full hearing. They had had enough of the nightmare and didn't want to have to sit through further descriptions of Jasmine's violent death. Jenner would later speak of how, as time passed, and with the trial and inquest over, the help offered initially by doctors and therapists began to wane. The McMonagall family, though, were still feeling the impact of Jasmine's untimely death. Their sleep and memory were affected. Moving past it seemed impossible. Not knowing where to turn, they had to go looking for any support they could find. Jenna began to focus on keeping her sister's memory and legacy alive. A memorial bench was erected in a playground in Killigordon, and the family set up Smile for Jasmine, which helps to raise funds for a variety of good causes, including Alone, the national organisation to help older people age in safety at home. Jasmine always had the greatest of respect for the elderly. Shortly after Jasmine was killed, people across Donegal held virtual tea parties organised by Smile for Jasmine to help raise funds for vulnerable people during COVID-19. Friends of Jasmine also raised nearly €5,000 for her two girls, while a GoFundMe page was also set up and to date has raised over €11,000 for Jasmine's family. The McMonagall family planted an oak tree and erected a plaque in Jasmine's memory in Castle Finn. Over the last few years, that tree has grown nicely. In January 2025, on the sixth anniversary of her death, a candlelit procession was held from the town centre to the tree, in memory of the mother of two. More people turned up than the family were expecting to hold candles and say a few words about Jasmine. Jasmine's sister Jenna has also remained vocal about Jasmine's death and the prevalence of femicide in Ireland. Speaking to Katie Hannon on the Upfront podcast in January of 2025, she said, "A lot needs to be done for things to change. This is happening on a regular basis. I know that if it was the other way around, if it was me and if it was Jasmine that was here, she would be out there talking for me. So I have to speak for her." Figures from Women's Aid Femicide Watch show that since 1996, 271 women have been killed in Ireland, the majority of them by current or former male partners. Richard Burke is due for release from prison as soon as July 2029. Jasmine's family have described this as a sickening insult to her memory. A spokesperson for the family said he will be free to roam the streets again after 10 short years. The family found the idea of a verdict of diminished responsibility hard to accept, and have spoken about how his previous threats to harm Jasmine tell them that that night was not an isolated moment. I am reminded of Jasmine's mother Jacqueline's description of Burke. The only word that comes to mind is evil. Does evil exist? I don't know. I do believe that there are lights and there are shadows, and that the two cannot exist in the same place at the same time. From what I've come to learn of Jasmine, she was one of the lights. But sometimes, tragically for those left behind when the light is extinguished, the flames that burn brightest sometimes burn for only half as long. In many of the articles in the media written about Jasmine, she was described as an aspiring actress and model. This is untrue. Jasmine was first and foremost a mother, and her dream was to be an author of children's books. Even her email address reflected this. Writer girl. At the time she was killed, she had been writing her first book. But now, sadly, that story, and hers, will never get the endings that they rightly deserved. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. If you are enjoying the podcast, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating or review. We have nearly 2,500 5-star ratings on Spotify, with a growing number of reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thank you. These reviews help new people discover the podcast. We are reading every comment, and we genuinely appreciate the time you take to share your thoughts. Please keep them coming. If you're listening on Spotify, please leave a comment below on this episode. Let us know what you think. You can also get in touch with us directly by emailing linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. We'll be reading your emails in an episode of Case Notes in the coming weeks. That's our new second strand of this podcast, available here as well. You can also keep up to date with the podcast on our Instagram page, Lines of Inquiry Podcast. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Siobhan Walsh and Siobhan Maguire are our producers. This episode was written by me, John Sweetman, and edited by Owen Brennan. Sound design and editing by Neil Kavanagh. Legal, marketing, and social media support comes from the team at Go Loud. If you would like to support the series, we'd really appreciate it. Please share it with a friend on WhatsApp, post it to your social media, or simply recommending it to someone you know. It makes a real difference. Join me next time as we open another case and follow the evidence wherever it leads. Because, in the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.